Good morning here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. I am Matt Jordan here on this Wednesday morning, 62 degrees outside. And joining me in studio on a Wednesday is the Wildcat Extension District, Jesse Gilmore. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how are you enjoying the weather right now?
In oh my mornings, gosh, it feels so nice. Yeah. I was down in Dallas this past weekend and almost died from the heat. So having any temperature below 70, even though it's not going to last through today, it's nice to be out in this kind of weather.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got a couple things we're going to talk about here in the 7 o'clock hour, but one of the things I know you wanted to hit on was cicada killer wasp, right?
Yeah, so... oh gosh, maybe it was a couple weeks ago now. I had about 5 people bring in wasps or ask about wasps that they thought were murder hornets because they were just so big. Those are actually going to be cicada killer wasps, and they are very alarming because they are about as big around or as long and as big around as my thumb. So when they're flying at you, they are very concerning because you have no idea what they're going to do. And, you know, with murder hornets being in the news a couple years ago, some people thought that that's might be what they were. When people talk about murder hornets, what they're actually talking about is the Japanese giant hornet. And those were only in the Pacific Northwest, as far as we can tell. They never got into our area, and they pretty much died out. Or at least got out of the news pretty quickly. So that's not something you're really going to see down here. I will have a couple of identification tips here in a little bit. But cicada killer wasps are the largest wasps that you're going to be able to find in our area. As I mentioned before, about as big around and as long as your thumb. And they live up to their name. So the adults are pollinators. They feed on nectar and... at flowers, and they take the pollen from one flower to another. But in order to feed the larva, they actually sting and paralyze cicadas, and they drag them back to their nests, which are in the ground. They're burrowing wasps, as opposed to paper wasps that form those nests on structures. And they drag the paralyzed, but not dead, body of the cicada back to their nest, where the larvae then feed on the body of the cicada. So it's pretty gruesome as far as the animal kingdom goes. But it's interesting because even though cicada killer wasps are as big as they are, the cicada will still weigh about twice as much as the wasp does. So you see it climbing trees with the body of the cicada in order to fly back to the nest, because they have to get as high as they can on the tree, because they're just going to start dropping with the cicada. And so they have to make it pretty much the entire way back to their nest just from the tree where they find this cicada. They burrow when they form their nests, and that can cause problems in lawns. I have had a couple of people asking me about their nests underground, especially in lawns that are more manicured, you know, constant mowing. That can cause problems with interfering with the nest. And while males do not have stingers, they are going to fly aggressively towards you, pretty much charging you in order to try and get you away from the nest so that they can defend it. Females do have the stingers, but they primarily use them on cicadas. So in very rare instances, you're going to hear stories of cicada killers stinging people, but that is definitely not the norm for them. But you do have options for control if you did want to try controlling the cicada killer wasps. Don't know why I was blanking on that. But you would want to spray some kind of pyrethroid insecticide around the entrance to the burrow. It would probably take 3 or 4 applications in order to get enough chemical applied to the wasp in order to kill it. Usually, though, I will recommend not trying to kill these insects, because they very rarely attack humans. there's minor aesthetic damage to the lawn because of the, you know, the dirt that they have to dig up in order to form their burrows. But they're also pollinators, so they are good to have around. And especially if you have a ton of cicadas in your area that just keep you up all night, like I did last year, they can keep the cicada populations down, which can in turn benefit crops that cicadas feed on. As far as identification goes, cicada killer wasps, if you capture one, they're going to have three broken yellow, kind of creamish yellow stripes on their abdomen, and the rest of their body is going to be black. If you think you have a murder hornets are going to be orange and brown, and the orange stripes are uninterrupted on their abdomen. So they are pretty easy to tell apart just by color, but those stripes and their continuity on the abdomen are another dead giveaway, whether or not you're looking at a native wasp like the cicada killer or an invasive wasp like the Japanese giant hornet.
Yeah, I was looking up some pictures of them, and I can understand why people might be a little... They are huge insects.
Yeah, we posted a picture on our Facebook page about one that people had brought in that was in pretty good condition, and I kind of backdropped it against a piece of white paper. But what I should have done is I should have included either, you know, some part of my hand or a ruler for scale, because I don't really think that that picture does enough justice to just how big these wasps are. Yeah, they're about 2 to 3 inches long in the biggest case scenarios. So, yeah, very alarming when... they're flying right at you in order to protect their nests. But they are also solitary wasps. They do not form hives like paper wasps do, or other types of stinging insects like honeybees or yellow jackets. Luckily, yeah, yellow jackets are so much worse than cicada killer wasps are in terms of attacking people and in terms of swarming.
Big fan of cicada killers because I don't like cicadas. They annoy me. So
cicadas are... just as freaky. I can't tell you how many times I've walked past my house and there's one on the wall, and then they do that really loud like buzzing as you get close to them, and then they fly off, and every time it makes me jump. So I'm not opposed to cicada killer wasps in the slightest either.
So you had another topic you wanted to discuss this morning as well.
Yeah, so I was down in Dallas this weekend, and I visited their botanical garden, and I got to see a very interesting growth pattern of crepe myrtles. As you know, Dallas is, I think, 2 hardiness zones below us, which means that they don't get as cold in the winter as we do. And at the botanical garden, they actually had crepe myrtles that were growing up to 25, 30 feet tall, and in tree form more than in shrub form, which is an interesting topic to talk about because a lot of people, and this was me as well before I started learning about trees and shrubs, most people think that plants have to be one or the other, you know, you either have shrub forms that stay decently small, or you have tree forms with one single stem or maybe 2 stems if it forks, and there's really no in between. But there are shrubs like crepe myrtle, like serviceberry, hydrangeas I've seen as well, that have what's known as a standard form, which is one single stem that grows the entire tree form. So a standard is essentially a tree form of what is commonly a shrub. And crepe myrtles can get to that size in Dallas because they don't get as cold in the winter. Up here, we still get too cold to where all above ground portions of a crepe myrtle would die off. But because they don't get those cold temperatures in Dallas, you're not going to get the same thing. You're not going to get the dieback that you get. So they can grow taller over multiple growing seasons. And that's one thing that you need to keep in mind when selecting plants for our area is what our minimum temperature is during the winter. There are plants that are more cold hardy than others. I've done some research on some things, and I've recommended some plants to people that are hardy down to zone 2, which is central Alaska. So it can survive very, very cold winters, colder than we are hopefully ever going to get here. But there are some zoned plants that will not grow here. fuchsia is one of the plants that will die off because it's just a little too tropical or subtropical. Passion fruit is another one. We do have a hardy version of a passion fruit called a maypop. It is not quite the same species, and it won't have the exact same fruit, but it is much more cold tolerant, so you could see passion flowers growing in our area naturally. Other good plants that would be probably need to come indoors. Pretty much any type of citrus outside of the kumquat. The kumquat is actually going to be the most cold hardy of the citrus, cold hardy to about 15 degrees, which you barely ever see on other citrus trees. So if you did want to try growing citrus, you would probably need to do that in a container that you can bring inside during the winter to protect it from the cold. But kumquats, unless we get a really cold snap, should be able to survive, especially if you have the right microclimate for it, like on the south side of a house where heat is being reflected off of the building with the low sun in the sky.
So what is it you mentioned, you know, a plant you can bring in the house or a citrus that you can, what does that process look like? And what do you need to do with the plant different from it being inside than outside?
So when you have a plant inside, you absolutely have to make sure that it gets enough light. And that's going to be putting it near windows with cold heart or with cold insensitive plants like citrus. You do want to make sure you keep them far enough away from the window that it's not getting drafty, because the area right next to windows can have some of that cold air diffuse in, so it can be colder than the rest of your house. You do want to make sure that you don't overwater plants. Overwatering plants is one of the most common mistakes people make with indoor plants. But for cold sensitive plants, you would only really want to bring them in during the winter. The rest of the time, they would do much better outside than they would inside.
All right. Well, we are almost to the top of the hour here. Anything quickly you want to add before we get to the top of the hour, or are we good to break and come back?
If you do have any questions about what type of hardiness zone plants would work best, there is a little bit of flexibility in what hardiness zones we can grow here, just because microclimates are kind of a tricky thing to nail down, and they change from landscape to landscape. You can always give our office a call, and I can give recommendations on, you know, what plants would work best, what plants might not be a good idea for our area based on their cold tolerance or cold intolerance. And you can get in touch with me at the Girard office, which is 620-724-8233, or you can email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. Well, that if you have any questions about plants for the winter or hardiness of plants or cicada killers, or if you think you found a murder hornet, give Jesse a call. But we are about to take a break here as we approach the 8 o'clock hour. When we come back in the 8 o'clock hour, we will hear from Wendy Powell coming up in at around 8:10 or so here on the Mighty 690. Good morning here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. I am Matt Jordan here on this Wednesday morning in the 8 o'clock hour as we are joined by the Wildcat Extension District. And we heard from Jesse in the 7 o'clock hour. Now we're going to hear from Wendy. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Glad to have you in. And we're going to be talking about the vaccination process.
Yes. So a lot of folks are early weaning their calves to
release some grazing pressure on pastures. So I thought this would be a good time to talk about vaccinations and vaccine handling. A lot of times we are in a hurry to get the job done, but if we are overlooking the practices to be followed, then we might not be putting effective product into those animals and thus throwing money away. And that's certainly not something that we need to be doing this year.
Yes, absolutely. Everything else is expensive enough as is. Don't want to ruin any vaccines.
That's right. So, that's right.
And they can be a little expensive sometimes too. So.
No kidding.
But they're needed.
That's right. So the first step is getting your vaccine to the farm. So a lot of times we work with a veterinarian, and we have, producers should have what we call a veterinary client relationship, veterinary client patient relationship, sorry, VCPR. And essentially what this is there is a veterinarian that knows about your operation and has worked with you to make for sure that you're applying, you're giving vaccines that are known in the area to be effective, and the veterinarian is going to take responsibility of the care and the treatment of the animal, the judgment of that. So whenever a producer works with a vet, then there's just that stronger relationship of having someone back you up, or someone that you can call with questions, things like that. Sometimes it's a written document. Sometimes it's just a handshake agreement. So whenever you're getting through this process, a lot of relationships look different. So that's the first thing to have. And then whenever you go to actually get your product, whether that's from a vet or from a feed store, depending on what product it is, or if you're having it shipped in from a supplier, there are a lot of things that you need to look at. So the first thing to know is storage temperature is 35 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit. So that will be on the label of the product. So whenever those are delivered to you from the mail, make for sure that those packages have been kept with an ice pack. We've had some really high temperatures, so you need to know that that vaccine has been kept at that constant temperature, not too hot, not too cold, so that the vaccine is going to be effective whenever you put it into your animal. If you're working with the feed store, make for sure that the feed store knows how to properly store their vaccines. Like, they're checking their supplier, they're checking their refrigerators where they store the vaccine to make for sure that it's at that constant within 10 degrees. So if it's not, then you want to not use that vaccine, whether you return it or take the loss. That's up to you, but don't use a vaccine that has not been stored properly.
Is there risks to it other than it just not working like it's intended? Are there like adverse risks for the animal if it's not properly stored?
Sure, that's a great question, and the answer is yes, there can be. So each vaccine is different, depending on what it's used for, what it's mixed with, things like that. So if a vaccine gets too hot or too cold, yes, it could potentially change chemically to be toxic or to be simply ineffective. That would be a best case scenario, but the toxicity we surely can't afford.
All right, and then so when you're, what is the storage process? Because it's easy to keep it in a climate-controlled refrigerator, right? But what does it look like when you're transporting it maybe from the feed store to your home or the vet's office to your home? And then, or, you know, when you're transporting it from your storage location at home to the field, to the chute, to what does it look like for that?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of times, you just need a simple little cooler, like a six-pack cooler. Throw some ice packs in there. Don't leave those on the dash. Don't put your vaccine bottles on the dash of the feed truck. One, for sunlight. We don't need that sunlight hitting the bottles. And secondly, the temperature there can fluctuate a lot. So if you're going to buy vaccine, just throw a little cooler in and have that ready. You have space, you'll have the space available to transport that. And that's from the feed store to the ranch or from the ranch to the processing facility.
All right. And then, you know, when you're out there in the field doing the vaccinations, it could be hours. You know, and you got your hand on the bottle, you got the warmth of your hand, you've got it wherever it's sitting. So what does it look like chute side?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, you only want to mix enough vaccine, only put enough vaccine in the syringe to be used within 1 hour. So if you know that you're dealing with difficult livestock, you know, that 1 hour might be fewer head than if you're dealing with livestock that are flowing you have a lot of helpers on hand that can keep those animals moving through the processing facility. And so you don't want to get too much vaccine in the syringe that's just going to sit there for more than an hour. And then once you have that in your syringe, a lot of livestock producers use syringe guns. So it looks, it's got a handle with a barrel and the plungers from the backside kind of behind your hand. I know you can't see what I'm doing here with my hand, so sorry, folks. But that syringe gun, they make these fancy syringe coolers. And they don't have, you don't have to purchase one of the fancy ones. You can modify a six-pack cooler that you might have. And essentially, you're putting a hole or a couple of holes, however many syringes you're needing, into that ice chest. And then you can just, between animals, you can just put that syringe gun down into the cooler. And there's an ice pack in there. And the needle is protected. And that, that vaccine, while it's in the syringe, is protected from sunlight. It's in a cool space. And it's kind of off of the working table. So I don't know how familiar you are, Matt, with how a shoot side table looks. Sometimes it's a tailgate that's pretty clear. You only have the supplies you need. Sometimes it's a table that's covered with a lot of stuff.
Ours was a rusted barrel turned over, and we used the bottom of it as the table.
There you go. So yeah, that rust, it's another influence there that could cause some problems. And whenever you go to lay that syringe down, it's also something to consider whenever that steel syringe is hitting that metal table or tailgate or whatever. If it's not laid down properly, you can get burrs, bends, and broken needles just by handling the syringe, let alone going into the animal. So that's something else to keep an eye on, is that actual needle. Change it out every 10 head or so. There are bloodborne pathogens that you don't want to spread from animal to animal. Anaplasmosis is a big one this time of year. That is a bloodborne pathogen spread by ticks and flies, so also by syringes. So change the needle out every 10 head or so. Keep an eye on burrs, bends, and broken needles. Switch those out. A lot of different things to consider. If you are using a modified live vaccine, so these are the ones that come in two different bottles. You have your liquid and you have the powder. So that is a modified live vaccine, and you only want to mix enough for an hour again, but use a transfer needle on those. Don't be putting the liquid into a syringe and then shooting it into the powder bottle. Use a transfer needle and do that properly. And the other thing that I forgot to go back to, when we're talking about on-farm storage, after you've got the vaccine to your place, make sure that the fridge that you're using is working properly. Because I know, at least in my situation, the fridge that goes out to the barn is the one that quit working in the house. And if you're putting some high-dollar vaccine in the fridge that quit working in the house, you are throwing money away. So I'm not saying that you can't fix the one that was in the house and move that one to the barn. That's fine. Just monitor that and make for sure that you know that that vaccine is going to be kept 35 to 45 degrees. Otherwise, it goes back to that conversation we had a few minutes ago about ineffective vaccines that could potentially turn toxic.
Yeah, you know, you'd think it's simple. Just you got the refrigerator, you know the refrigerator's going to work. But anyone who's ever had food spoil or lost food because of a refrigerator or freezer going out knows that it's not that simple.
Yes, so. Exactly.
All right, so what about record keeping? Because I'm sure you want to make sure you're not over-vaccinating or vaccinating, you know, wasting medicine because you're not making sure you're doing it as often as you should. So what does record keeping look like?
Yeah, so record keeping looks different on every operation. And so for vaccines specifically, you want to keep track of which vaccine that you are which you're giving to the animals. Just jot down the date that it was administered, which group you're working with, like which pasture or, you know, who owns them, whatever. then, of course, the product name, and then the dosage that you're administering. And then go ahead and jot down the withdrawal time. That's something to take note of. Here in America, we don't harvest animals that have antibiotics in their system. And we know that because the withdrawal time is followed on these vaccines and any other medications. So whenever you administer a vaccine, then you have to follow that withdrawal time and not send them to a sale barn or to a harvester. So these vaccines, it's something to keep note of if you ever have problems with a small group of animals that you think maybe a vaccine did go bad that you used. And whenever you have the information there on hand, like you took the label off of the bottle and you kept that, then you know for sure that can be addressed. And that's something to work with your veterinarian on. Processing records are always something to be kept, and that's just, sometimes it's just a notepad next to the chute where you're jotting down, you know, tag numbers, and maybe you have a scale, you can jot down the weight or the gender of the animal going through the working chute, and then it's just the records that you can go back to and say, yes, for sure, this number 304 calf was indeed administered blackleg vaccine on, you know, August 31st.
All right. And so when you're looking at like vaccines, so say you've got a bigger bottle of a vaccination and you don't want to transport the full bottle and you've got smaller empty bottles, is there a way to safely, because in my head I just picture sticking the needle in and then sticking it in the other and pushing it. There's got to be a easier way to transfer, or should you not worry about transferring one vaccination from another?
That's a great question. So only use original bottles. I would not transfer bottles. So if you have a really large bottle of something that you're not going to use all of, then maybe you should have purchased only like a 10 dose bottle or a couple. Like if you have 20 head, you don't want to purchase a 50 dose bottle, even though it's cheaper. You want to purchase 2 10 dose bottles, because storing that extra 30 doses over time can be a problem, and you want to use the most effective vaccine. Again, it might be cheaper to buy the bigger bottle. Buying in bulk usually is, but at the same time, we're looking at effectiveness in the animal and not wasting any money. So going with those smaller bottles is definitely the way to go there.
Is there expiration dates on vaccines, I assume? And I assume it varies by vaccine.
Yes, exactly. So there are expiration dates, and those are always on the carton and on the bottle, both.
All right. Well, we talked a lot about, you know, storage and the vaccination itself. What about where to vaccinate and how to vaccinate when it comes to the specific animal?
Yeah. So on cattle specifically, we have this area in the neck called the triangular mass. So that's in front of the shoulder, behind the ear, below the vertebra, and above the dewlap. So if you can picture that area, it's not really rectangular. It's kind of like a trapezoid. Is that the word my first grader would use? I think. But we call it the triangular mass because we like to be simple and not complicate things. So the triangular mass is where we want to aim for. And you want to look on the bottle of how that vaccine should be administered. If that's a subcutaneous vaccine, then you use a shorter needle and you just go under the skin and not into the muscle. And if it's an intramuscular vaccine, you want to use a bit of a longer needle, maybe a 1 inch, and you go into the muscle. I can tell you that a lot of vaccines, the majority these days, are subcutaneous. And so you use that shorter needle. You kind of go in at a 45 degree angle into that triangular mass to not get into the muscle. You can even kind of tint up the skin, like pinch a little bit of it and pull it up and then put the needle in. That pocket there, that would be another thing to do, but you don't necessarily have to.
Is there, I guess, outside of the spot, is there certain techniques that you want to to follow, or because, you know, I think about myself getting a shot. I'm not the most steel person when I'm getting, you know, a needle injected in me, and then cattle are completely different creatures. So, you know, they're not calm and still either.
Sure. That's exactly right. So you definitely want to make for sure you're using handling facilities, and you're not, if you are roping and I hate to use the word throwing animals down, flanking, there we go, flanking animals to give injections. That's one thing. You make for sure that you have enough helpers on hand to restrain the animal properly so that there are not any injuries to the handlers or to the cattle. But usually folks around here are using working facilities with squeeze chutes. And so those animals are put into those squeeze chutes, and they're pretty limited on their movement. So their stomach area is squeezed down a little bit, kind of like a hug. And then their head is through the head gate that restricts them from going side to side for the most part. Now, I have seen a lot of calves get in a lot of positions that are really wonky, but proper handling facilities are key to make for sure that those animals are properly restrained, because we don't want any injuries to the animals or to handlers. So there certainly are some techniques you can use. Thinking of the different squeeze chutes that I've seen, there are some bars that you go between, and you certainly want to be cognizant of if the animal moves X way or this way, then you want to make for sure that you'll be able to extract your hand that's holding the syringe from that space so as not to get injured. So a lot of times it's just looking at your handling facilities and adjusting properly.
All right. Well, what other things do we need to know about the vaccination process?
Yeah, always make for sure you use the correct size needle and read the label on how that injection should be administered and follow those directions. I know it's a pain to read that tiny font, but it's super important. And if you have any questions about handling or handling facilities, things like that, give me a call. I'm happy to visit with you about that, or really build that veterinary client-patient relationship. And I can be reached at 620-784-5337.
All right. Well, appreciate both of you coming in this morning. Always look forward to these chats on Wednesdays. And if you have any questions when it comes to specific plants and what to do with the hardiness of them, or questions on cicada killers or any other insects like that, give Jesse a call if you got any questions when it comes to livestock, whether that be the vaccination process or drought or feeding. You can give Wendy a call. So, thanks to both of you. We'll talk to you guys, someone from K-State next week here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.